met with the other schools this afternoon and heard a presentation with Justice Babbage. So, having said all of that, I now call the third case for today, 99-1204CR, State v. Glenn Schwepke. Mr. Finley, Attorney Keith A. Finley of the Frank J. Remington Center, appearing for Mr. Schwepke. Mr. Finley.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. Roberta Tuig and her family were traumatized by Glenn Schwepke's mailings. They were understandably upset and frightened by the unsigned letters with newspaper articles chronicling their past achievements, 45 RPM records, and messages of affection. And the law protects them from those unwanted contacts. But that does not mean that Glenn Schwepke, by sending those mailings, committed the crime of disorderly conduct. As a matter of law, he did not, because he did nothing disorderly that posed a threat to public order or good order, or that was likely to cause a disturbance or a breach of the peace. The issue in this case really is, does the disorderly conduct statute have no discernible limits? Is it just a generic, all-encompassing crime that applies to whatever conduct a jury might deem sufficiently antisocial and upsetting to merit criminal sanction? Or is it instead a criminal offense broad but not endless in its application, whose limits can be discerned by reference to, number one, the statutory language, number two, the statutory scheme into which it fits, three, its legislative history, and four, the constitutional limitations that have shaped its development in the legislature and its interpretation in this court. Considering those four factors, I believe, it becomes clear that the disorderly conduct statute does not apply to the conduct at issue in this case. And I propose to discuss each of those considerations in turn. First, as to the statutory language. The statute, of course, has two elements. One, the conduct must be one of several enumerated types of conduct, including violent, abusive, indecent, profane, boisterous, unreasonably loud, or it must be otherwise disorderly conduct. It's not one of those specific types of conduct. And two, that conduct must be engaged in under circumstances which tend to cause or provoke a disturbance. Now, in this case, there was no claim made, there was no charge filed that Mr. Schwepke committed any of the six enumerated types of conduct.
Also,
yes.
When I read 947.1, this first thing that jumps out to me, whether in a public or private place, and looking at the recent decisions of the court, cited by the opposing counsel, Douglas A.S., it would seem that this is a little different because, as you argue, those were public, but yet they were semi-private, private in the sense that A.S. was communicated in an ice cream parlor, and Douglas D. was in communication primarily between his student and the teacher, not broadcast. Why wouldn't this fit into that category?
This, it seems to me, was conduct purely of a private harassment nature. You're right that there can be some private aspect to the conduct. In fact, the statute expressly says that it applies to conduct committed in a private or public setting. But what the court has been, what the cases all are clear about is the type of conduct we're talking about. It's the type of conduct that either directly causes a disturbance of the public peace or is likely to provoke in retaliation or in response a disturbance to the public peace. In Douglas D., the communication was in a, as you know, was an essay turned into to the teacher, which you might view as being somewhat private in nature. However, it occurred, and the court pointed this out, it occurred in a public setting, that is, in the school setting, where there was the likelihood to disrupt the proceedings in the school. So the conduct was of the type that might provoke a public disturbance in the sense that the public classroom setting could not continue to function as it ought.
This is my, okay, and if that is true, then there were two communications to Robbie. One was at her home, the other was at her place of business. She was in the same profession, teaching profession. And the communication was then shared, if I understand it correctly, with others as that's where I didn't really see.
There are a couple of differences, though. Number one, in this case, the school setting was a mere fortuity. It had nothing to do with the communication itself. The communication in Douglas D. had everything to do with the school. It had to do with everything to do with the relationship between teacher and student. It was a threat, at least at some level, it was a threat to chop off the head of a school teacher because of the way she was conducting the class, and there were findings made that there was concern that she interpreted this as a threat, that if she disciplined this child again in the public school setting, that this child would harm her. So it had that very direct connection to the school setting and to the functioning of the classroom. In this case, this communication had nothing to do with the school, and it contained no threats. So it was a very different nature in that regard. The fact that she received one of these mailings had really nothing to do with the case.
Mr. Finley, if I came to your home and you invited me in and then I used abusive language, no one else was in the house, just you and me. We're there, and I, okay? Is that disorderly conduct?
Well, it might, depending on the circumstances, and that's why the second element requires the court to consider whether this abusive language was undertaken under circumstances likely to cause or provoke a disturbance. Now, there's a couple.
Well, you're very disturbed at my abusive language, okay. And you might very well have liked to hit me, but you didn't.
Okay.
You're very provoked. You're very provoked. You're very disturbed.
The circumstances.
Does that just disturb you? Is that enough?
I don't think so. If you upset me, it's not enough. Chief, if you came to my home and swore at me, I'm not likely to retaliate physically because of the circumstances, because I know who you are, because that's not the type of setting.
Suppose I'm a casual acquaintance, but have enough confidence, you let me in your home. And then I use abusive language and I walk out. I never tend to hit you or do anything else. Is that going to be...
Again, I think it depends on the circumstances, and the question is it likely to provoke a retaliatory response from me? And if it is because of what you say or because of the context of our conversation or the context of our relationship, if it's likely to provoke a retaliatory response from me, that then is the type of conduct that could provoke a public disturbance. Anytime you might provoke...
But if it's all in private...
Well, yes, it's in the privacy of my home, but once you start talking about violent acts, once you start talking about me wanting to haul off and slug this person back, we're talking about the kind of behavior that has the likelihood, the potential, to spill over to affect the larger community, to affect the public.
Mr. Finley, what is this public disturbance business? I don't read anything about public disturbance in the statute.
The statute doesn't use the word public. In public disturbance, that phrase. You're right about that. But the court, consistently over the years, has interpreted the statute to apply to disturbances to the public peace, to disturbances to good order, to public order.
The court has used public disturbance and good order.
Yes.
Don't necessarily use them together. It would be perfectly natural to use the term public disturbance in a public place, in a public setting. But the statute also refers to in a private place.
Yes, it does. My understanding of that is the conduct can occur in a private place, but only if it's the type of conduct in a private place that threatens to spill over into a public disturbance. Now, the reason I think that it matters that the court uses the term public disturbance is because if you look at the genesis of this statute, and if you look at the way that public that disorderly conduct statutes have been justified and fit within constitutional constraints, the courts have consistently said it's because the government has a legitimate interest in preventing disturbances to the public peace. It's like a breach of peace statute. This court, as recently as Douglas D., said that the purpose of this is to prevent public disturbances, to prevent breaches of the peace. That's why that language matters. And yes, it can occur in a private place, but it has to be the type of conduct that threatens, even if it originates in a private setting, that threatens to spill over and create a disturbance to the larger public context.
Could I give you a couple of hypotheticals here?
Sure, absolutely.
This actually happened. Last Saturday morning, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm sound asleep in my apartment. Someone starts to buzz the buzzer to get in. I figure out, they just hit the wrong buzzer. And then a couple minutes later, it's buzzed again. And then it's consistently buzzed. And I go out and I say to the person, don't do this anymore. I'm going to call the police. And then they press the buzzer again. Okay. Now, I'm alone. I didn't react. As far as I know, no one else heard. Is this disorderly conduct or not? Why not?
It very well could be. The difference there is, however, that's the type of conduct. Number one, it's abusive and it's unreasonably loud. So it fits within one of the enumerated categories. That's part one.
Reasonably loud?
Well, if it's unreasonably loud, if it's disturbing you during the night when you're sleeping or trying to have calm in your quiet, if it's repeated, it might fit under that. But beyond that, it's so annoying and harassing that it does provoke you to come out.
Harassing
to come out. I would think it would be, in the common usage of the term, that would be a form of harassment to constantly ring someone's buzzer when you have no legitimate purpose for doing so. It's the kind of conduct that's... that could provoke someone to respond. Now, you came out and told them to stop, and they didn't stop. It doesn't matter if you did not, in fact, retaliate in a disruptive way. What matters is whether there's the potential, and that type of conduct might, under some circumstances, in fact, have the potential to lead some people to respond in a loud or even violent manner. So if that's the case, then yes, it could be disorderly conduct, even if you personally didn't respond that way.
Well, let me give you another hypothetical. I find out your home address, and I stencil your name and address on the letter, and I put in a note, have a nice day, but I also put some powder in there. Comes to your home.
Okay.
Early conduct.
It might be. I mean, that's obviously much more threatening than what
Malcolm powder?
Well, after the anthrax scares we've had, yes, of course. Before September 11th, maybe not. Probably not. But after September 11th, yes. Sending someone talcum powder and a stenciled letter has an unmistakable message to the recipient that I may be threatening your life. And the response then, of course, on your part is going to be fear. But more than that, your neighbors may become alarmed. It could create hysteria.
How are the neighbors going to become alarmed from a private letter?
Well, because probably word is going to spread. It doesn't matter whether you tell anyone or not. The likelihood is that if my neighbors receive talcum powder in the mail, probably most of the neighborhood's going to know pretty soon, and it is going to be something that may disrupt the whole neighborhood in a very public sort of way.
Well, beyond the reaction of the other tenants in the apartment building, isn't the hazmat team sent out? Won't the hazmat team be sent out? And won't the building be quarantined? And won't the post office from which the letter came shut down for a period of time?
Absolutely. So the response will be very widespread, and it will be, in fact, disruptive to the community because the area will be quarantined, people can't get in and out. So, yes, you're absolutely right about that.
Mr. Fenley, in this particular case, isn't it reasonable to assume that Ms. Robbie or Roberta, after a while, is going to become very angry, irritated, upset, and may indeed want to respond to this in an angry way herself?
I mean, what is far-fetched by saying that?
Well, I don't think it's far-fetched at all for you to say that she's going to become frightened, upset, distraught.
And might want to respond. Might want to say, stop this. Put an end to this. I don't want this anymore.
It's well,
possible.
Because I think the nature of this type of communication between them is not the kind of thing that's going to provoke an immediate physical, violent, disruptive kind of response. It's more likely to cause the kind of response it got, which is that she went to the police. She called the police and said, this troubles me. And that is the essence of order, not disorder. That is the appropriate orderly response, and that's the most likely kind of response one's going to get from unwanted neighbors. That, it seems to me, is really what this kind of contact kind of communication is all about.
The test for the tendency to cause or provoke a disturbance is an objective one. We don't look to the specific reactions necessarily of the victim to measure it, although that may be relevant evidence.
That's exactly right. That's right. So the victim's response is a tool to help us understand the likelihood that this conduct would provoke a response, but it is not necessary nor sufficient. It's just a tool in helping us gauge that. I think you're right about that.
There was evidence in the record in this case about the victim's sensitivity to this sort of harassment being heightened because of previous harassment, is that right?
That's right.
And that was admitted as relevant to what?
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you.
I know, we're having trouble with the sound system, I apologize. That was admitted as being relevant to what, if this is an objective test? And we don't look to the peculiar sensibilities of the victim.
I think it was admitted, and it was a very limited piece of information, of evidence that was admitted. Just simply, the only evidence that was really admitted was evidence that she had been harassed in the past. And the point of that, I think, was to show that her response was not that of a hypersensitive person, but rather that it was objectively reasonable under these circumstances for someone to be alarmed and upset by those feelings. So again, it went to the circumstances, because when you consider contact like this, or the conduct of this type under the disorderly conduct statute, you look at the entire all of the circumstances. So that's what that was.
What circumstances do we have in this case that we can look at? Obviously, to me, perhaps not viewed the same by others, obviously the content of the letter in and of itself, when not applied to any circumstances, does not have violent, indecent, profane, boisterous, unreasonably loud, or otherwise disorderly conduct on its face. So, what circumstances does this record support that we are able to do? That make what would be, I hate to say this, given the facts of this case, but in another context, this writing could be viewed very positively.
Yes, it could, and in fact, the prosecutor viewed it just that way in the trial court, noting that it would be very difficult to make a case of harassment or stalking because the writing was, in fact, complimentary. That is certainly one of the aspects of this case that I think demonstrates that this is not disorderly conduct.
What circumstances are we able to use to apply to this arguably benign letter that makes it or keeps it out of the realm of disorderly conduct? What can we use? What's the state using? What does the court use?
You're asking me what are the circumstances that might push this over to make it disorderly conduct?
Well, of course, that we have in this record.
Well, of course, I don't think there are facts in this record that push it over into that realm. And the state would point to the fact that these were stenciled, that they were anonymous, although I point out they weren't truly anonymous. Everybody knew where they were coming from.
My question is a bit fuzzy. Let me see if I can clarify it. The jury wasn't given certain
circumstances of past conduct. Based on the circumstances of past conduct they were given, how does that apply to the words of an otherwise benign letter? Does that help at all?
I'm sorry, I'm struggling. I'm not sure that I'm...
You know what? I'll just pass then.
I'll try to give it a whirl.
You're both two and
then I'll ask you a question. Is the word abusive, I imagine that includes physical abuse.
I don't think so.
Verbal abuse?
It might, but when we start getting into the verbal area, into communication, we have to be particularly careful to make sure that the...
Didn't you cite a report from 1953 that talks about how the new disorderly conduct statute, place verbal abuse in some previous statute?
I don't believe that the word abusive replaced something else. That's the 1953 statute rewrote disorderly conduct. The point we were making about that was that the legislative history shows that this type of private contact, this type of private disturbance, private harassment, was never intended by the legislature to apply. To be governed by disorderly conduct, because in fact the legislature wrote a separate subsection under the disorderly conduct statute that applies to that type of private.
Let me ask you this. Did you do a word search of abusive in the statutes and see how many times it's linked to psychological abuse?
No.
But could we read psychological abuse into the word abusive?
You might, under some circumstances, I suppose, but there's two points I want to make about that. One is that that's not the way this case was charged, so the term abusive really doesn't matter here.
How was it charged?
It's charged strictly as otherwise disorderly conduct.
But you want that otherwise disorderly conduct to relate back to one of the words that precedes it.
It should be connected. It should be related. In fact, this court has said.
I'm suggesting that that could be abusive, not only physical and verbal and psychological.
It could be. But again, once you start talking, remember, we're talking about communication. These were mailings. When you're talking about psychological messages sent through mailings, we have to be very careful to keep it within the constraints imposed by the Constitution. And what the Constitution, and this court recognized in Douglas D., the Constitution imposes limitations on how we can apply and construe this statute. And when you're talking about communication, you have to fit it into one of the exceptions to make this unprotected speech. So you can't just say anything that causes psychological torment to someone could be disorderly conduct. I mean, there's all kinds of protected communications that might bill collectors, the IRS, whatever it may be, could cause all kinds of lawyers sending out letters to opposing parties. There's all kinds of mailings that you could send to another party that might be psychologically abusive in some sense. But what the Constitution says is you can only punish that. Fit it into one of those categories of unprotected speech, such as threats or conduct that incites people to imminent lawlessness, conduct of that, communications of that type. There's simply nothing here in this communication that would fit any of those categories. I see that I'm running out of time, so the other point I want to make very clear is that the statutory scheme that we end up makes it, I think, crystal clear that the legislature has contemplated harassment of the type we may have an issue in this case, has contemplated private insult and injury of this type, and has expressly moved it out of the disorderly conduct statute, created separate harassment statutes to deal specifically with that, included specific proof requirements such as intent to harass that are not included in the disorderly conduct statute, and has provided different penalties, which are in fact lesser than the disorderly conduct penalties. What sense would it make for the legislature to create specific harassment statutes with lesser penalties but more exacting proof requirements if disorderly conduct could do the job anyway? that cannot be what the legislature intended. So it seems to me that when we look at all those factors combined, and again, that statutory scheme is the product, in part, of constitutional constraints, because the legislature moved those private harassment provisions out of disorderly conduct and created more exacting proof requirements, because the courts in this state told them they had to. State versus Tronso, the Court of Appeals ruled that the annoying telephone call provisions of the disorderly conduct statute was unconstitutional because it was too broad, because it did not have specific enough proof requirements. The legislature responded by moving all that out, creating more specific proof requirements, different penalty schemes. Wouldn't that be something? Wouldn't that be just quite a surprise to the legislature and the courts in 1979 when Dronza was decided, and when the legislature moved private annoyance and harassment out into separate statutes? If they were to know that the annoying telephone calls provision of the statute was too broad to apply, yet the general disorderly conduct provision, which still exists in that same form today, could have done the job anyway. It makes no sense at all to think that the broader general disorderly conduct provision might do the job when the more specific annoying telephone calls provision couldn't. Given that statutory scheme, given that legislative history, given all those constitutional restraints, and given the fact that this court has consistently applied the statute in cases, in situations where there's the threat to a public disturbance and has consistently justified the existence of the statute on the basis that the state has an interest in preserving and protecting against breaches of the peace.
Counsel, there's an argument that you never claimed that this conduct is constitutionally protected or that the disorderly conduct statute is unconstitutional. Would you respond to that?
A distinct constitutional claim was never raised in the trial court, and therefore has never been raised as a separate, freestanding issue on appeal. The state is correct. The argument, if I could just finish responding here.
Counsel.
Thank you. The argument, however, there are several responses. Number one, if the court wants to treat this as a freestanding constitutional claim, it certainly has the discretion to do so. And this is a significant case that probably calls for doing it. Number two, however, the constitutional claims are not raised independently as separate grounds for reversing, but rather as tools to understanding how the disorderly conduct statute must be construed. They're tools in the statutory construction, and they are also an absolutely essential element of understanding the legislative history of the statute, because constitutional constraints have consistently, throughout the existence of this statute, limited both the way in which the legislature has drafted the law and the way in which this court has applied the law, has interpreted the law. So it's absolutely inconceivable to me this court could decide what the disorderly conduct statute means without considering those constitutional limitations.
Finley, are all of these documents that he sent to different people the same? That is, are they all treated the same? You can have one that's valid under the statute and two that are valid?
I'm not sure what you're getting at. I mean, the documents were all fairly similar.
It's all of them or not?
Well, I'm sorry. No, that's not true. It seems to me that some of them make a weaker case for disorderly conduct than others. In particular, documents sent for the mailing sent, for example, to Mr. Lamke and to Patty Marchenko, who did not have the history of harassment, and the documents sent to Mr. Lamke was a single mailing with 45 RPM records, nothing more. And it was not something that he even recognized as threatening or alarming, particularly alarming at the time. That wasn't sent under circumstances that intended to provoke a disturbance. So, no, I think there are differences among the various mailings. It's conceivable that some could fall or understand, but I think they all fall.
And then the one to Robin is the most difficult because of the past history.
Because of the past history.
That goes back to what were you able to show, or what the
state was able to show at trial as to the past history.
And the state was able to introduce very little of that.
I think that was the point of Justice Bradley's question.
Thank you, Chief.
No problem. All right.
I'm sorry I didn't get it earlier. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Finley. You've got 5 minutes rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This is not a typical disorderly conduct case. It does not involve a drunken brawl in a tavern, a person shouting obscenities at passersby, or a domestic dispute that has gotten out of hand. It involves anonymous mailings sent by the defendant to a woman who was the object of his obsession and prior harassment. Mailings that, while they contain no explicit threats, sent a clear and chilling message that whoever was sending these mailings was watching the victim's every move. The defendant's mailings deeply disturbed both the recipients and their families. That this is not a typical disorderly conduct case does not mean that this is not a case of disorderly conduct. That is because the disorderly conduct statute prescribes harm, prescribes conduct in terms of the results that reasonably can be expected from that conduct, rather than attempting to enumerate the limitless number of antisocial acts in which a person could engage that might tend to cause a disturbance. The defendant has argued that this case involves only a question of statutory interpretation. If the issue in this case were whether the sending of a disturbing mailing can ever constitute disorderly conduct, that would indeed present a question of statutory interpretation. That's not the issue, however, because the defendant has acknowledged in his brief and in this argument that under certain circumstances, sending a mailing may constitute disorderly conduct. The defendant in his brief gave the example of a bomb threat. I, in my notes and upstaged by Justice Prosser, gave going to give the example of the mailing of powder. Disorderly conduct looks at all the facts and circumstances. Unfortunately, under current circumstances, mailing talcum powder, I believe, would constitute disorderly conduct.
Under, could you just say that last sentence again, please? Under what circumstances?
Under current circumstances, I believe mailing talcum powder would constitute disorderly conduct, even though 2 months ago, the defendant also argues that the disorderly conduct statute only reaches disturbances of the public order, and that only a private disturbance is involved here. The reach of the statute to private disturbances does present a question of statutory construction. It's the state's position that the statute does encompass private as well as public disturbances. The defendant doesn't identify any specific language in the statute that it would exclude private disturbances. To the contrary, as the court counsel had noted during the argument, the statutory language expressly refers to private as well as public places.
Is a restaurant a private place or a public place?
I think it would be considered a public place in the...
empty. No, late lunch, no one's there.
I suppose if the restaurant were closed and it's just the employees involved in an altercation, that might be private, but because of the language of the statute,
it's not it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter about the place, yeah. It's how many people.
Right. Now, I think perhaps the defendant is arguing that how many people there matters. And
I don't think so.
I don't think it does. Let's return to the example, since it is unfortunately timely, of the mailing of talcum powder. I think the defendant, without any hesitation, would agree that the mailing of a letter with powder to a governmental office or to a business office, would at the very least ask to disorderly conduct. The question was asked during Mr. Finley's presentation, well, suppose we were in a private home. Now, in my preparation for this, I was prepared to argue, well, under the defendant's interpretation of the statute, that would not be disorderly conduct. But I didn't hear that answer from the counsel for the defense. The answer I heard was, maybe it would, because of the disruptive effect. And I think perhaps that's really the key to what the court should be looking at in determining what is the kind of disturbance, or at least that it is one possible way to distinguish the purely private from the disturbances that the disorderly conduct statute is trying to get at. There are some disturbances there are some annoyances that are purely private. But conduct, even in the private setting, can cross the line to where it is so disruptive of ordinary functioning that it crosses the line and it can be punished as disorderly conduct. So,
where is that line?
I think the line I'm going to probably equivocate just as Councilman the defendant often said, it depends. I think outside of the facts of any specific case, it may be hard to tell. The line, if it's just a matter of hurt feelings, that is not enough. Certainly the possibility that there would be a retaliatory response is one thing that would indicate that the line has been crossed. And I heard that often during defense counsel's argument, this idea of retaliation. And I have to say that while preparing for this case, one of my colleagues said, you know, where I come from, these kind of things had gone on, Nicholas' brother would have found this guy and whipped him upside the head. So I don't think it's the kind of thing that you can say, well, this is the kind of stuff that would have never intended to provoke a retaliatory response. It didn't hear.
Also, line drawing would be like a letter of the after appendix. I will always love you, sign never, I will always love you, Robbie. Mark.
Certainly, I think for each mailing, you have to look at the total context. Certainly, a note, I will always love you, Robbie, on its face is not threatening, it's not ominous. In the context of the prior mailings, keep in mind, the first mailings had a more, reflected a more obsessive interest.
Well, if there's more than one, then what I was getting at. Had that same language and it was mailed once or it was mailed 100 times, that might make that's
absolutely might make a difference. And that's why we had questions about what difference does it make that there was harassment before and during New York. And Justice Sykes, you asked, well, if it's an objective test, what difference does it make? And I think the answer is you look at the reasonable person who has this background. Of prior harassment. So I think the fact that this victim and her family endured 10 years worth of harassment in the past are part of the circumstances. The reason the state did not get in more evidence of the past history is because as the trial court was wrestling with this question prior to trial of how much prior history should go in, it was clear that the court was very concerned that this would be used as propensity evidence. And that was before the defendant had stipulated that he was the source of the mailings. So the prosecutor, in an effort to forestall future arguments, perhaps appellate arguments about whether this whether this was coming in just for propensity, agreed to very severely limit the amount of past conduct information that came in.
Hasn't the line always been drawn at public breaches of the peace? In other words, private conduct may be encompassed within this statute in a private place, but unless it has the tendency to cause or provoke a disturbance of a public nature or a public breach of the peace, it's not prosecutable. Isn't that where the line has always been drawn in the case?
I think...
That's why domestic violence cases are covered, because while those often occur in a private place and it's private conduct, it does have the tendency to cause a breach of the public order, because it has a tendency to spill over.
I'm not sure that it always does. I think, you know, a domestic disturbance in a rural farmhouse, no neighbors in a mile in either direction, but the
The statute and the jury instruction doesn't say it has to always cause it, or in fact that it must, there must be evidence of a disturbance having been caused, only that it does that tendency.
That's right. But I don't know that that, given my hypothetical of the remote or the isolated domestic disturbance, where there really, I don't think there's any more tendency to spill over than there were under the facts of this case.
Do you agree with the statement that I just made, though, that the cases do draw the line at public disturbances? We don't prosecute cases of private disturbances under the disorderly conduct statute unless they have the tendency to cause a public breach of the peace, because otherwise the second factor isn't met.
No, I don't think the second factor, the disturbance, requires, I guess I'd have to ask you then what you understand by a public breach of the peace. I don't think it requires the likelihood that there's going to be a commotion, a disruption of lots of people. I think because you know, the disorderly, the domestic cases, I think, have that same limitation.
I'm not suggesting a breach of any particular magnitude, but I'm talking about the public-private distinction, and that's what this case is about. First of all, whether private conduct, which constitutes pure speech, can satisfy the first part of the statute, which is focused on the conduct, and the second part of the statute focuses on its consequences or tendencies. And you've got to have both before somebody can be convicted under the statute. And as I read the cases, the first part says, yes, private conduct in a private place can qualify, but only if it has the tendency to cause or provoke a disturbance of a public nature, not of any particular magnitude, but at least of a public nature. Otherwise, we don't prosecute it.
Well, the case is really, I think the previous cases, quite frankly, have never really focused on that public order. Some of the cases use public order as a phrase. Some of the cases use good order as a phrase. But all of the reported cases in this court have dealt with those kinds of public disturbances in the public setting. So I think the court really, I think it's an overstatement to say that the prior cases have drawn the line.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think the legislature intended by this statute to get at conduct which produced only private disturbances that didn't have a tendency to provoke a public breach of the peace?
Yes. I think the legislature, if you look at the legislative history of the statute, there was a deletion. The statutory language as originally drafted required the disturbance of the public order. That public order language was taken out, I think, of course, between the drafting and the passage. So I don't think we can necessarily say that there is public order component.
Well, is this a case of first impression then?
I think it is. I would agree that it is. The court's prior disorderly conduct cases have all taken place in the public arena. Whether
involved in communications holding people in the street.
Douglas D. It was
ABCD.
Douglas D was the communication, and I think Douglas D is actually fairly comparable to this case. It was the private communication. Now, the communication took place at the school. Justice Wilcox, I believe, asked Mr. Finley earlier, why isn't this like it? And I think it is. I don't think it's sufficient to say here it was a fortuity that it was sent to the school. It was the defendant addressed it. He chose to send it to the school. And I think it had a disruptive effect at the school. The teacher was saying, I was afraid to go to the mailbox. We called on the police to investigate. This is comparable to the statement in Douglas D, or to the tendency in Douglas D to cause a disturbance.
Counsel, I'm sorry, are you finished?
Yes, I am.
I'm going to shift a bit, because some of the responses, both by your opposing counsel and you, in response to hypotheticals, your response, it depends, or could be, or it's hard to draw a line. And that, of course, raises to me the reality that it's difficult to have a disorderly conduct statute applying to speech, which is a written letter. And one of the reasons is because such application is chilling. You don't know until after the fact. You don't know until a court has said you've gone beyond that line whether or not the language you spoke was going to go beyond that. And that's part of the First Amendment's about. And I have problems with this conduct meeting the true threat test that we recently established. I have problem, I mean, this is obviously speech. Speech can be prosecuted if it, in this instance, falls into a category of a true threat. We look at our definition of true threat. I don't think that it fits it, so I say to myself, well, we can come up with an opinion. This court can come up with an opinion. This court can say, let's say the court that decides in your favor, and this language comes within, this conduct comes within the language of disorderly conduct. But it's not constitutional as ever. I mean, should we do that?
No, and there are two reasons. The primary of which is someone, I believe it was the chief, asked Mr. Finley, are you claiming that this was constitutionally protected? And he acknowledged that there has been no claim made. So we've never even...
He said no specific claim, but it's kind of interwoven. You look at the legislative history. But, I mean, I just have a...
Parties waive claims by not raising them. And
so do you think overbreath was waived, or you think vagueness was waived, or both, or neither?
There was never at any point, certainly not in the trial court, and not in the appellate process, any constitutional claim made. The most we have heard from the defense is that the constitutional considerations should inform the court's understanding of the statute. No claim that the statute is vague, no statute that the language here was constitutionally protected, no...
Isn't the rule that you interpret this statute that affects speech so that you make it constitutional?
Yes, but I think that would require a claim by the defendant that this is unconstitutionally applied and an explanation of why other than that assertion. I haven't spent much time thinking about could this fit into the true threat, but this is threatening It is not an explicit threat of harm. But Justice Prosser was asking about psychological abuse, and I think there's at least a threat of psychological harm.
But there's no doubt in my mind that this can and was exceedingly threatening. I mean, this is horrible. But that's different than meeting the test of
The true threat test threat doesn't require that it be a threat of physical harm.
No, but it requires that they interpret as a serious expression of a purpose to inflict harm.
Well, I think a reasonable person in Mr. Schwebke's position should have anticipated that a reasonable recipient of this would interpret that as an intention of infliction, psychological harm. I don't think you can send clippings that meticulously document 10 or 15 years of a person's life and send a record that says, every step you take, I'm watching you, and not anticipate that's a threat of inflicting at least psychological harm.
Let me ask you this. There is this harassment statute.
Yes.
Why shouldn't the court just say the prosecutor overcharged and we've got a perfectly good harassment statute? Let's leave it at that.
We do have a perfectly good harassment statute, but the fact that it doesn't answer the question whether there is more than one statute that could apply to this conduct. And, you know, I think that you could just as well say, well, gee, the harassment statute also talks about someone who strikes or kicks someone with the intent to harass, and say, gee, you shouldn't be charging a battery. You've got a perfectly good harassment statute. You could have charged that. So I don't think that answers the question. When there is more than one statute that is potentially applicable, the fact that the court says, gee, it fits into harassment, doesn't answer the question. I think when there is more than one statute potentially applicable, we want prosecutors to exercise their discretion. And this record demonstrates, I think, candor and thought on behalf of the prosecutor far beyond what you will often see, certainly in a misdemeanor case, in the prosecutor giving extremely careful thought to what are the potential charges, what would I have to prove, why would harassment not be enough. I think I can prove harassment, he said. But given the severity of what happened, this is not enough. And I think there's also the problem of, I think, that the harassment statute applying the course of conduct would have given the defendant one free kick at each of the victims. I don't know that under the course of conduct analysis, the mailing to Ms. Marcinko or Mr. Lampke could be prosecuted at all. They each got a single one.
Well, on page 31 of your brief, you say the jury also could have found that the anonymous mailing to Mr. Lampke with his insinuation of homosexuality sent to him at his workplace at the sheriff's department also crossed the line from the merely annoying to conduct that outraged the sense of public decency. What conduct is that?
I think, again, because disorderly conduct looks at a totality of circumstances, this is sending a kind of a sly insinuation to Mr. Lampke's workplace at the sheriff's department that he is gay. I think sending it that to his home, maybe that wouldn't have been. Sending if Mr. Lampke worked someplace else, maybe that wouldn't have been. Sending that kind of message to an officer who works in the macho paramilitary world of a law enforcement agency, that's more outrageous.
Well, the paramilitary macho law enforcement officer is supposed to protect everybody, including gays and lesbians.
Absolutely. But the insinuation, but I think it could tend to cause a disturbance if it provokes suspicion among...
Right, does the sheriff's department, are they authorized not to hire gays and lesbians?
Absolutely, but I think it turns a... Whether it's legal, whether it's whether it's appropriate for fellow officers to be uncomfortable, distrustful, whatever, of a fellow officer who might be gay, I think we can't turn a blind eye to the reality that that's the kind of working environment where it could cause a problem. Whether it's reprehensible, whether we approve of it or not, I think doesn't matter.
So you punish the sender, but not the people who receive it.
Well, the person who receives it, certainly not. And there was evidence in the record of the kind of disturbance it caused. I mean, when Mr. Lapke received this mailing, he went around and he started accusing those who he thought at the department were maybe sending this, and it turned out to be a mistake, and he had to apologize. So,
that was in the past, though. That didn't deal with these, did it?
As I reread the record preparing for argument, I think I misassociated with the past incident. As I reread the record, I think he testified that when he got the latest mailings, the ones that were charged...
I thought, at least the Court of Appeals opinion, paragraph 12, says, Lampe also testified in the past, before either of the above-mentioned mailings, unsolicited, etc., that was the problems in the workplace. I didn't read the record. I'm just referring to the Court of Appeals rendition of the record.
Yeah. I don't know that I should...
Take the
time to find it in the record. But my impression was, rereading the record, that it was the charged mailing that caused him to make the accusations to his fellow officers and have to...
Well, assuming that the Court of Appeals is correct in its opinion that that was in the past and not the charge, does that make any difference in your analysis?
I don't think it does, because, again, the actual disturbance is not the prerequisite. It's the tendency to, whether it's a mailing in the past that had an actual disturbance, I mean, that would be probative of the next mailing's potential.
Is the disturbance set forth in the Court of Appeals' opinion sufficient under the law? And they describe the disturbance as the mailing disturbed Lampe because, given the previous anonymous mailing, he inferred that the contents of this mailing were intended as a reference to homosexuality. Is that the legal standard?
I think that's probably not quite enough. I think, as I conceptualize what a disturbance is for purposes of the statute, hurt feelings, annoyance, are not enough.
Assuming the Court of Appeals, as it continues in the next paragraph, is correct that this prior disturbance at the workplace dealt with prior mailings, and I don't know if it's correct, but assume that was correct, then what do you have to sustain Lampke's conviction under your argument?
Because the charged mailing also went to the workplace, so whether the charged mailing resulted in an actual disturbance or not is not the issue. It's the tendency. So if a similar kind of mailing previously caused a disturbance, I think that's probative that the next mailing of a similar kind would have a tendency to cause a disturbance regardless of whether it actually did.
If my reading of the Court of Appeals opinion is correct, and I mean both literally and intellectually, that the disturbance referred to by the Court of Appeals in paragraph 11 is only a disturbance because he inferred that the contents of this mailing were intended as a reference to homosexuality, that would not be sufficient under the law.
I don't think hurt feelings alone, I would not suggest.
Well, and could a dialogue between two people in which one person referred to the other as a queer, would, Couldn't that serve as fighting words, in effect?
Yeah, certainly. Now, particularly in a face-to-face situation, sure. We agree.
And that's enough to be disorderly conduct?
I'll quote my colleague and say, it depends on the circumstances.
Two of you all alone in a living room.
Let's say it occurs in a purely private place and only the two people, the speaker and the listener, are present.
And
all the doors and windows are closed.
All the doors and windows are closed. It's just one person getting his feelings hurt. No.
But enough to, if he's of a different temperament, another person might sock him.
Right. And, you know, and
no socking.
And I think the jury instructions and the court's interpretation of the statute in terms of a hypersensitive person standard, or avoiding the hypersensitive person standard, fits in. So I think you'd have to look at exactly what language was used, how persistent it was, what's the whole context, how did it come up.
This gets to the heart of it. Let's assume that the letters in this case can be construed as otherwise disorderly conduct, either because they are significantly similar to abusive conduct because of the psychological abusive effect that Justice Prosser spoke of, or for some other reason. Let's assume that. Why should we read the statute to encompass purely private disturbing tendencies?
Well, I guess I'm going to qualify the answer by saying, even if you excluded purely private disturbing tendencies, the facts of this case go beyond it. We have mailings that it was reasonably foreseeable that would cause a disturbance beyond the individual recipient. We have testimony about how these reasonable people started worrying about their mail, that Ms. Tuig was feeling more safe when she was out of the country, that coworkers were on the alert to if you see anything strange.
Is causing a disturbance the same as disturbing? I know that may sound like a strange question. I'm not going to pass on this one. That is causing a disturbance the same thing as disturbing another person?
No, because disturbing another person, I think, would include the hurt feelings and the upset that by itself is not the kind of disruptive, the tendency to cause the disruptive effect.
Well, what's the difference? You talked about other people being disturbed, and I transposed that to, of course, this is awful. It was disturbing to other people. But does being disturbing to other people, is that sufficient to cause a disturbance under the terms of the statute?
I think it does. If it starts to be group disturbing, yes, I think it probably does. See, my time is up.
Red light is on, Mr. Castle. Thank you. Mr. Finley has 5 minutes to rebuttal.
Thank you. I think this exchange really sort of sharpens the distinction we have here and the problem we have with the way the state interprets the statute. The state says that the statute encompasses private disturbances as well as public ones.
You're going to have to speak up, counsel.
I'm sorry. And that the statute encompasses private disturbances as well as public ones, and that the key is disruptive effect. The result is the problem we've seen here. And the result is that there is no clear line. What divides disorderly conduct from non-disorderly conduct? There is a line, and here I do not equivocate. Here I want to be very clear. The line is that conduct crosses the line and becomes disorderly conduct under this statute when the conduct is likely to directly disrupt the public peace or to provoke a response that's disruptive of the public peace. That is what this statute is all about. That's the genesis of it. That's what gets it past constitutional limitations, and that's how this court has always described it. We are not writing on a clean slate here today. In Douglas D., this court declared, the purpose of the statute is to, quote, root out conduct that unreasonably disturbs the public peace.
Okay, well, does A talk to B and use language that's offensive or abusive, let's say abusive, and B does nothing about it, and no one else hears it? Is that disrupting the public peace or provoking a response that disrupts the public peace?
I'm sorry, if A says something to B?
Very, very offensive.
Well,
it might provoke somebody to hitting. It doesn't provoke A into response.
If it's fighting words, something like that, that gets around constitutional constraints, it conceivably could be prosecuted as disorderly conduct. It's not, of course, not going to be.
It doesn't disrupt the public peace. All the windows are closed, and it did not provoke a response that disrupts the public.
Because there I have to concede the standard is not whether it, in fact, provoked a response, but whether its conduct of it has a tendency to provoke a response. The state's
interpretation. That's what depends.
I'm sorry, that would be depends, that's right.
Well, counsel, somebody sends notes like this to, say, my 10-year-old niece. Either her father or I would seriously tempted, I'm afraid, to go out and do something about it.
If someone sent notes to your 10...
Yes, sent to my 10-year-old niece. And exactly the same things that were here. Very much disturbed. Why isn't that tending to create a public disturbance? I mean, I might go out and pop this guy at the side of his head.
I suppose in some way that's closer to disorderly conduct than what we have here, but even still, I think even though it might anger someone, even though it might perturb them, it's generally not likely to result in, especially in an immediate breach of the peace in that way. Sure, someone might do that. Someone might respond that way to double parking. Someone might respond that way to all kinds of offenses.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, in this case, from a factual standpoint, weren't the friends and the family of these people disturbed? Didn't they take, I'm thinking about just the testimony, that they took precautions. They were, when we talk about public or private, obviously it was a private communication which was made public, because brought into a family circle, certainly the ex-boyfriend and the sister and the mother and the dad.
Yes.
That tended to cause a disturbance and make them fearful or take precautions or wonder, because of the continuity of what happened here. You not only had the verbiage, but you had the record watching.
There's no question. I'm sorry. There's no question that family and friends were upset, were disturbed. But you're likely to get people being upset and disturbed no matter what the offense is. Libel, slander, anything like that. Most torts are going to upset family members and friends because they're going to talk about it. People will be upset. And I think here we get to what Justice Bradley was getting at. I think you're right. There is a difference between disturbing someone and creating a disturbance. A disturbance, as it's used in this statute, given the historical way in which the statute has been approached, means a breach of the peace, a breach of the public peace. And it's not enough that individuals be upset or disturbed in that sense, because that is not a breach of the public peace. Thank you. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Finley. Thank you, Mr. Kess. That concludes our hearing on 99-3204 CR, State versus Schwepke. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:30.